Welcome to Write or Die Ghosttober, where we talk to authors who write spooky, scary, or disturbing books and find out all about their writing process and how they keep readers hiding under the covers.
I'm Clara Bell-Ortega, author of Ghost Squad.
And I'm Kat Cho, author of Wicked Fox, and this is Write or Die.
So I just got back from Frankfurt, which was
an
experience. And a lot
How
of it was good. I mean, it was okay. I mean, I was working, but a lot of people do ask me sort of what goes on at Frankfurt and like what is it? Like, what is Frankfurt? And first of all, it's a big show. Like, if you've been to any shows ever, any book shows, just picture that. But 12 buildings, and each building has 4 floors. So multiply it by that.
I see.
It's enormous.
So, like, so giant that you will immediately have an anxiety attack.
Well, maybe. I mean, it depends, because you don't necessarily have to go to all the buildings. Like, it's not like you go and you immediately see all the buildings at once. But if you do try to take everything in one day, I feel like it could be a lot. But basically, Frankfurt is a foreign rights show. So if you have an agent and they are trying to sell your foreign rights, or your publisher is trying to sell your foreign rights, basically what they do is they go there and they meet with foreign publishers, and they sort of pitch them the books that they think that they would like. So there's this like whole center. They moved actually too, because they used to be in the sixth hall, which is the building where I work, and they moved to the fourth one, I believe. Maybe they just moved, and which was like a big scandal. Everybody was like,
"Okay," because I was like, "I have no context for this."
They were like, "Oh my gosh, we're moving!" But I think everyone seemed to like it. I'm not 100% sure. So basically, the agents, like, let's say, like, you know, like, let's say, New Leaf will have like their own table, and like the New Leaf, like, foreign rights agents will be there, and they'll be taking meetings all day from like French publishers and foreign and German publishers or whatever. And they'll be like, this is the book, like, these are the publishers will be like, this is what we're looking for, and they'll be like, this is what we have, and then hopefully there's a deal that happens. And I guess I don't even know if this is public. I think it is, but I think the book that people were like the most excited about was this one that was Princess Diaries meets Crazy Rich Asians.
I know exactly which one you're talking about. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah,
one,
so that was like the I guess the buzzy one that people were really excited about at the fair. But I will say, like, the past 2 or 3 years, maybe, there hasn't been like a big breakout title like there was in previous years, where like everybody's freaking out about it and stuff. To the point where they're even talking about it and like it spills over into like the online world. I haven't really felt that excitement and buzz and stuff, but yeah, that's basically what goes on at Frankfurt. There's a lot of business to business meetings, and then there are like, I believe it's also the fourth hall where the public is, and they sell books there, and there's also a place where authors come to give talks. Last year I saw Victoria Aveyard there, and Karen McManus was there this year. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's an experience. Like, if you can go to it, I think it's something worth seeing, because you sort of see what goes into making the book industry what it is, which can be like sobering and exciting, but it's a lot more than I feel like people realize and expect, you know?
Yeah. Well, Frankfurt is all age categories, correct?
Yeah, it is. It is all age categories.
Okay. And then Bologna is the one that's just children's literature?
Just children's. Bologna, Italy is just children's. It's a smaller fair, but it's like everyone loves that show because of where it is, and like the hall is nicer, and it's like there's windows and the food, obviously. Not to say that people don't love Frankfurt, but I think Frankfurt is like a lot more stressful, especially for like scouts. Okay. Remember we were talking to Rebecca and how it's like so like fast paced, and you have so much work leading up to it. Frankfurt, it can be really like overwhelming. There are a lot of like there are a lot of meetings, and there's like stuff after the fair too, like dinners and events, and it's just very jam-packed, which is why I'm exhausted when I get home always. But it is definitely really interesting.
You were telling me earlier that you saw Karen McManus at Frankfurt, though. So would you say, like, Frankfurt has a lot of author presence? Or is that just a fluke?
I don't know if it's a lot. I wouldn't... There are definitely some authors there. Like I said, like last year I saw Victoria Aveyard speak, and then this year I saw Karen, and there's like a handful of authors always, but it's not like an author focused event, because the way that it works is the first few days are just for professionals. So like for you to get a badge to get into Frankfurt, like the first couple of days is really, really expensive. But then the weekend is actually open to the public. So you can get really cheap tickets to go. And those are the days that they usually bring the authors in, because that's when the readers are there. Saturday and Sunday, which this year I was only there through Saturday, which is the first time that's ever happened. But Saturday and Sunday is open to the public, and they have readers, and they have tons of cosplayers. It looks like Comic-Con in one of the halls. Everyone's just like dressed up. If you go out into the courtyard, there's so many costumes. It's actually really cool. It's a lot of people, like I said, but it's a really cool experience. And so there are authors. I don't know if there's tons of like YA authors. I wouldn't say a lot. In all the years that I've been going there, that I can remember off the top of my head, it's been like Becky, Albertalli, Karen McManus, and Victoria. There's definitely been more than that, but those were the three that I got to see while I was there. And I don't know that there's like, there's probably like three or four YA authors there every year, if that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, at least, okay. At least American. At least American. Bologna?
Oh, okay.
Bologna, I don't know. I don't think so. I've never been to that show.
I don't know why I thought you've gone there.
No, I'm always begging my bosses to send me, but they won't because they're evil. But I would I would love to go to Bologna.
Do they listen to our podcast?
My bosses, no. They don't know anything that I do.
What if they listen to just this episode? If you're listening to this episode, I like you guys.
We'll be fine. They know that I've been pushing to go to that show for a while, and it's just never happened. But I don't think that Bologna has authors, but I could be completely wrong. Like I said, I've never been there. The only thing I know is like from what I've heard from my boss's side of things. Yeah, that's basically how Frankfurt works. And those are not the only rights show. There's also Beijing, the Beijing International Book Fair, Guadalajara International Book Fair, but they're not as big for like rights related things as Frankfurt.
I see. Yeah, it's always really fascinating to hear how certain things work, because honestly, we know so little. And I really loved the episode with Rebecca, because she was able to give a lot more insight from the scout point of view of things. From the author point of view of things, it's like really hit or miss if we even know what's happening with our books, if they're like even being presented at Bologna or Frankfurt. Like sometimes I do know that like sometimes like my publicist will send me like a little picture of like a pamphlet that has like my book in it, and I'll be like, oh, that's so cool. But it's never like a huge deal. It's often as like an afterthought of like, oh, by the way, look, there was like your book was in this pamphlet. Yeah. Or I know that like I feel like as authors, we hear about it more when our agents are talking about like, oh, let's go on sub at this time because we want to like hit before Frankfurt, or we have to wait until after Frankfurt. That's the time that I mostly heard about it before I ever sold my book. But then our friend just sold a book, which isn't announced, so I won't say the friend or the book, but they sold it like, I want to say like a week or two before Frankfurt. And they were telling us that they already got an email from their editor being like, this is the add-in sheet. They made like a flyer to like add into their pamphlet because it was such a fresh sale that they wanted to take advantage of Frankfurt, I guess.
Yeah.
But they had already printed up all of their booklets.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a lot of times it is a very strategic thing. Trying to like be like that buzzy title of the fair that year or
Yeah.
whatever. But from like I don't know if anyone saw the thread that Molly Kirhan was sharing on Twitter. Molly is a great resource at these shows because she's like really great at sort of like disseminating what's going on. But she was talking about how, you know, it's still very hard to sell kid lit, YA, especially middle grade. They're wanting, especially the UK is not really wanting American middle grade right now because they have like their own specific humor and like I guess the own thing that they're going for. So really it was like more adult stuff. Women's fiction. I'll try to include that in the show notes, that thread that Molly did. That might be really helpful just for people to get sort of like a perspective of what agents are seeing, because you know agents that go to these shows or bring reports back to their agencies then can sort of say like, hey, this is in terms of foreign rights at least, this is like what the industry is talking about and sort of like wanting and not wanting. So it's not just like a place to sell and buy stuff, but it's also a place to see sort of like what's going on in the industry as a whole worldwide, as opposed to just in American publishing.
That makes so much sense. And it's something that we don't really talk about a lot as authors, partly because we have no idea why half the things happen the way they do in foreign rights, but also because sometimes the things that we know could be disparaging for someone who's just getting into the industry. I mean, I'm speaking specifically as a person of color and like underneath that as an Asian woman, just because a lot of the information I get about foreign rights is from Asian authors who've come before me and just talking about how if I remember like I was explaining what book I had on sub when I was on submission for Wicked Fox. I was telling this Asian author that I really respect, and they were like, "I'm so excited for you. I hope it sells. You know, it sounds like it'll be really great. Foreign rights might be hard." And I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. Why did you say that?" And so this author was like, "You know, to be completely honest, like Asian culture, like it just isn't a big sell in a lot of international markets." And there were a lot of other reasons that they had, and it was good to know ahead of time because I had zero expectations for foreign rights, and I feel really lucky actually because I have sold a couple of them. But in markets where there's kind of already a base, a fan base, because like K dramas are really big in like Latin America, and I sold foreign rights in Latin America because you know that's it's like a thing that people are already fans of, you know. So it made sense when it happens, and I'm not trying to tell people like don't expect to ever sell foreign rights. I'm just saying like it's such a different beast and it's such a different market that there can be zero expectations because, like, even people who've been around for a really long time have no idea why things sell the way they sell.
Yeah, and Lamar Giles talks about this often, how he hasn't really sold many foreign rights despite being around for a long time and his books doing really well, and how there's this sort of imbalance between, you know, it carries over, I guess, the same imbalance of not as many POC having their books published and not as many having foreign rights sales. Oh, and speaking of, you know, POC versus white authors, we did get that really interesting email that we said we were going to discuss on the show. So, do you want to
Oh,
just
yeah.
quickly address it?
Yeah, and honestly, I don't really want to spend too much time, but I do think it's worth addressing, and I want to be very honest about it because I think that we've gotten some critique in the past where we think it's very valid. We like the one about the sound quality or typing or whatever in the background, super valid, and it was totally on us, you know, to be better. This email, if I were to boil it down, was from a person who I'm not going to give too many descriptors of them, but I will say that they were white. And they were saying that they appreciate our podcast, which we're very happy if anyone gets anything from our podcast. But then they went on to say that I was getting harder and harder for them to listen to. And that's because when we got more into recording the episodes, we started talking a lot more candidly about our experience as authors of color, and not just our experience, but comparing it to the experience that is presented as the norm within the industry, which is the experience of white authors. And we do this because we don't exist in a vacuum. Like, systemic prejudices do exist across this globe, and it affects people in all industries. And if we're going to be candid about our experience as authors of color writing our own heritage, then we have to acknowledge the system we're working within. This person felt uncomfortable. I won't assume that this is exactly what they meant, but I think that my interpretation was that they felt uncomfortable because we were making them feel bad about their whiteness.
No, they literally said that. They literally said that.
After, oh, they did. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we were making them feel bad about their whiteness. And they said, they pretty much, without saying the words reverse racism, was accusing us of reverse racism. They also implied that they had more of a leg to stand on because they had once lived in a environment, in a community with that was majority people of color, and that made them the minority, and therefore they had been, experienced prejudice because of the color of their white skin. Claribel, since I summarized, why don't you give your thoughts on this?
Basically, I just want to say, like, we love all of our listeners, all of them. And, like, we never want anybody to feel uncomfortable for who they are. But at the same time, we're not going to not speak our truth. And we're not going to pretend that there aren't imbalances in the industry, because that's the whole point of Write or Die. If you look at any of the descriptors, that is the whole point of the podcast. And if you can't handle us saying the words white person, which there's nothing wrong with, then there are plenty of other podcasts that you can listen to. You know, obviously we want all our listeners to keep listening to us and to find value in it. But it's sort of like a not all men type of situation when we're talking about problems that we have, and someone gets upset and says, well, nah, I'm not like that. And it's like, that's fine. Then it doesn't apply to you. Then you don't need to take it personally. But what we're talking about is systemic problems within the industry. And there have been studies on that. And, you know, I will include links to a few different resources in our show notes for anyone who's still confused about it. But we've talked about it so much, both online and on this podcast. And it gets really frustrating to have to continue to sort of humanize ourselves and to explain to people why these kinds of discussions are necessary, and, you know, why we have the right to laugh about situations and to make light of them, because we've been through so much within this industry from the very beginning. Just trying to get our foot in the door is really difficult. And we're not saying that it's not difficult for everyone, but we're facing additional obstacles that you can't even fathom because you haven't been in our shoes. And I would just like for people to sort of respect that and respect the fact that this is our platform to use as we so choose. And we're always going to be respectful towards individuals. But if it is a systemic problem, we have every single right to call it out and to talk about it in whichever way we see fit, because this is our podcast. And I really felt hurt by that email. It was racist. And it was the first time that we've ever experienced anything like that, which I'm actually surprised about. I'm surprised yeah, it took this, like, long.
It took so long.
I'm surprised it took this long. But I've never been one to hold my tongue about anything. And I appreciate every single listener, including the person who wrote the email to us. I don't hate her or feel any sort of, you know, animosity. I do think that they're way off base and that they're wrong, and that I wish that they would do a little bit more research into the problem of diversity in publishing before they got so offended and made it all about themselves, and just about racism in general, because they're just really off the mark about so many things. But we're going to continue to talk about things the way that we always have, and that's not going to change. And you know, we're here for all writers, but the point of Write or Die is specifically to highlight people who've struggled to get into the publishing industry, and nobody is more affected than marginalized writers.
Here's the thing, and this is not my quote, and I really wish I actually knew off the top of my head who said this, and I'll put it in the show notes because I'll look it up later. But when you're so used to privilege, equality sometimes feels like oppression. Mm-hmm. And I really think that people need to pay attention to that concept, because now that we are bringing up the conversation more about making a seat at the table and giving space to these marginalized voices, the assumption by people who've always had all the seats is that the seat is being taken from them. But publishing in the most idealistic form of it is not a zero-sum game. You know, making a seat, we've never ever wanted, marginalized creators have never ever wanted us for the seats that were given to be taken from somebody else.
Right.
We just want extra seats to be put at the table. And also this person, the things that they got offended by weren't even the most inflammatory things that we were saying. They were upset that we had celebrated one of the guests said, oh, I realized after the fact that there are no white people in my book. And we celebrated that. They were upset about that. Now, just to break that down really, really quickly, they were assuming that the thing we were celebrating was the lack of white people. No, we were celebrating the lifting up of people of color in this story, that the people of color filled every single space of this story. All of the main characters, the villains, the nuanced characters, the side characters, the random funny people who showed up, they were all spaces that were allowed to be given to people of color because for so long we were never given one of those spaces.
Right.
And even if we were, it was a throwaway character. So it was exciting for us that a book existed where we could fill all the space and be proud of it and celebrate it. We were not happy because, oh, yay, no white people. So the person who wrote the email was framing it from their white POV. They were centering themselves.
Right.
Well, you love that I'm not there? Is that what you like?
No.
That's a problem. Like, that's the core problem there. And we never, ever, ever, when we want to lift up people, want to do it at other people's expense. That's the big thing.
Right.
If you're ashamed of the fact that this is that the reason why people in power have powers because they've pushed other people down, then you need to address how that exists in the system and how that affects you and how you feel about that. Don't put that on us because we've been victims for our whole entire lives. We're just trying to get a little bit of air and a little bit of space. And we're not trying to push you guys down just because we want to be lifted up. We want everyone to be lifted up. Like Claire Bell said, this podcast is for everyone. But if it's upsetting to you, take your space. Self-care, mental health, very important. Step away.
I will also mention that this person seemed really frustrated that they're not getting where they want to be in their career. And I felt a little bit like they were sort of taking that frustration out on us a little. And I just want to tell you not to quit and to focus on your craft instead of things that are not going to get you to the place where you need to be. Because I promise you, writing an email to Write or Die is not going to get you an agent.
It's not.
For Lucelli Luna, ghosts are more than just the family business. Shortly before Halloween, Lucelli and her best friend Sid cast a spell that accidentally awakens malicious spirits, wreaking havoc throughout St. Augustine. Together, they must join forces with Sid's witch grandmother Babette and her tubby Tabby Chunk to fight the haunting head-on and reverse the curse to save the town and Lucelli's firefly spirit before it's too late. With the family dynamics of Coco and action-packed adventure of Ghostbusters, Claribel A. Ortega delivers both a thrillingly spooky and delightfully sweet debut novel with Ghost Squad, coming April 7, 2020 from Scholastic. Pre-order today at buyghostsquad.com.
This week's guest is Ellen Oh. She is a former adjunct college instructor and lawyer with an insatiable curiosity for ancient Asian history. She loves martial arts films, K-pop, K-dramas, and cooking shows, and is a rabid fan of The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra series. Ellen is the co-founder of We Need Diverse Books, a nonprofit organization dedicated to increasing diversity in children's literature. She is the author of the middle grade novel Spirit Hunters, The Spirit Hunters, The Island of Monsters, and the YA fantasy trilogy, The Prophecy Series. She is the editor of WNDB's middle grade anthology, Flying Lessons and Other Stories, and the YA anthology, A Thousand Beginnings and Endings. Originally from New York City, Ellen lives in Bethesda, Maryland, with her husband and three children, and has yet to satisfy her quest for a decent bagel. Hey, Ellen, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Great.
We're good.
Thank you for having me.
That bagel thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's hard to find a good bagel outside of New York,
Outside of New York. Yes!
This is why the quest goes on. It's never ending.
Do you have, like, a runner-up bagel place outside of New York at all?
Jersey.
Yeah, Jersey.
That's cheating.
Seriously, the next best bagels are always in Jersey. That's what I find. Anything outside of that area is, I don't know, it's kind of like cardboardy slash, you know, maybe it's bread. I'm not quite sure.
I agree.
But chewy. Like too chewy and weird and flat. Weird.
And just not tasty.
That's, you know, it's horrible, definitely.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got your first agent or how you got into publishing? We just want to know a bit about your journey, how you got to where you are today.
In the year 2000, Time magazine had a cover for The Man of the Millennium, right? Mm-hmm. Time Man of the Millennium, and it was Genghis Khan. And I was like, that's an Asian guy on the cover of Time. Like, we don't even get them for Man of the Year, but, like, they put them for Man of the Millennium. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of amazing. And so I got a biography on Genghis Khan, right? And in the process of reading about this Mongol, I learned all this history about China, Korea, even some Japanese history. It was really fascinating. And especially these kind of, like, stories about Korean history I had never heard about at all. And I thought it was really interesting. And I started to dig deeper into my history. Because, like, I mean, let's face it, when you grow up in the States, right, world history is actually just white history. Yeah. And I don't think I think for me, any indication of Korean history started the Korean War, if they ever talked about that, right? Yep. So I started doing a little research. At the time, I was also teaching, so I had access to, like, all the university libraries. Thank God for that, because that's really where I found all the relevant stories and legends and nonfiction books to kind of get a good idea of how fascinating it all was. And I was like, how come nobody's really written about it? I mean, yes, Linda Sue Park did that wonderful book, right? A Single Shard. But that's about it. I don't think there was anything else. Kat, what do you think?
Oh, no. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I definitely didn't have anything.
Yeah, I didn't know of anything that was kind of talking about Korean history. So, I mean, outside of also watching, you know, Korean dramas, you know, what we call the saga book, the historic, we didn't have any access to that. So I started to think about writing a book based on Korean history. And around that same time, of course, or maybe no, not around the same time, but earlier, much earlier, I had fallen in love with the whole Harry Potter series. And that, of course, made me really think that writing children's books was the way to go, especially because, you know, all of these things were kind of like, you know, coming to a head inside of me, because here I was getting this fascination with Korean history. And at the same time, I'm trying to buy books for my kids. And here I am seeing that there's not much more Asian books than there were when I was growing up, right? And, like, that all kind of hit me. And I was like, well, I'm going to write it then. I'm going to write a book that will be about my culture and my background and give kind of like an Asian hero for my kids to kind of look up to. So I started writing the Prophecy series. And that's an interesting story, too, because, like, I went to writers groups, I talked to editors, I talked to other writers in the industry, and it was kind of amazing to hear people say that there was no place for this book because they seemed to believe that nobody would be interested in a book about Korean history. and I remember an agent actually saying to me, literally, no offense, but ancient Korean history? Ew. I remember that.
Oh my
gosh. Oh my God. It's so horrible. Like, why is that okay? Why was that ever okay to say that?
Yeah, well, because she said no offense.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that she said that. That is total thought.
It's a fact. It totally changes it. No offense.
Anyway, the magic words.
Yes, right. So, like, I remember just, like, how hard it was to, like, get people to even think about the book. And I've always been kind of like that person that, like, if you tell me I can't do something, I'm more inclined to do it. Like, I just dig in my heels. You know, I will eat dirt, but I mean, I'm going to somehow do it because I just am that stubborn. So the more people told me that this book would never sell, the more I was intent on trying to prove them wrong. And around the same time was when I actually, I was at working for a nonprofit organization, and they had done one of those like major reorganizations, right? And I was no longer reporting to the people I wanted to report to, and they wanted me to take on much more of a role with not much more pay. And I was like really unhappy, and my husband said to me, why don't you just leave and write that book you've been bitching about for, you know, forever now.
I love those encouraging words.
yeah, exactly, just like that. And I said, okay, I will. But here's the funny part. Like, as I was leaving, I had this coworker that I had been working really closely with. And he was like, I don't understand. Why are you leaving? Why are you giving up, you know, being a lawyer? And I said, well, I have this dream to see my book published and be able to make a career out of that. And he said, yeah, right, pull the other one. And I said, what? I was like, who says that?
What?
Who says that in response to somebody telling you, I have a dream? Here's my dream. Yeah. And then I was like, I'm going to show this little punk bastard. Okay. So I have this, like, this, you know, this thing where, like, if you, the more you tell me I can't do it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are going to be a hater, it's just going to fuel me on more.
Yeah. I recognize that personality trait very well because I am the same exact way.
No, that's literally Clarabelle.
But, you know,
in the best way.
Yeah, but I think in some ways we need to be that way to survive, because otherwise all you have is a universe full of people who just want to drag you down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, every time a person of color wants to do something, there's so many people telling you can't do it in some way, shape, you know, or form. Whether it's like even your friends who are like supportive and at the same time, but you know, if it doesn't work out, like, you know, even there's, it's really hard sometimes to find that support network of writers out there, which is kind of why, I know I'm veering off subject, but it's kind of why for me, mentorship is such a important thing. Like, you know, here we are, like, we're making progress, we're opening doors, we're breaking new ground, and if we don't help that new, you know, group of writers behind us continue on, then what do we do all this work for, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I totally agree, and like, I think that's actually still on point, because I think, you know, it's, you touched on something where people give, it's so easy for people to give up when they don't feel like anyone thinks that they can make it. Like I think also the thing that was always hardest for me when I first said I want to start writing was not the people in the industry who said I couldn't do it, but like my own like family being like, are you sure? Like they didn't want to 100% be like, don't do it. But they were like, ooh, I just don't think, maybe don't do it. You know, and it was so clear that they were just like pretty much convinced it wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It's like really difficult to feel that, you know, but it came from loving concern, but it was still upsetting.
Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't help that we come from an Asian community that wants all of their kids to be lawyers, doctors, accountants, or something that gets a steady paycheck. And so there's not as much support for the arts. And that, of course, is a problem. If our community could support, all of our arts creators, then it could make it more feasible for people to be in the arts. You know, it's kind of like that cyclical thing.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
So I'm on my fourth agent now, right? So when I got my first agent, I had written Prophecy as a boy book. In retrospect, I don't know why I did that, right? I think I thought that a book from the boy's perspective would sell better. But the idea of the story hadn't changed. It was, you know, here is this prophecy, and everybody thinks that it's the crown prince that's going to be the hero, but it's not him, it's his girl cousin. That idea was the same, except I was telling it from the perspective of the boy, the prince, who is not the hero. I got an agent from that, though, and we did the first kind of round of submissions, and everybody came back and told me that my prince was an annoying asshole.
Oh, no.
No, seriously. They're like, oh, my God, he's such an annoying little shit. And I was like, okay. So then I decided to rework the entire book, and I realized what I should have realized at the beginning, which was that the story is stronger coming from the girl's perspective. And I thought it made for a much better book, but my agent wanted a boy book. He signed me because he wanted a boy book. And so he didn't like any of my changes. And to be honest, I will tell you this one thing that I have never forgotten. I had a typo in my manuscript. I don't even remember what it was, but it was like a typo, right? You know how like you're writing too fast and you put a stupid spelling?
Yeah, sure, sure.
And his response to me of this one word typo was, Ellen, is English your first language?
No.
Oh, no.
That is so beyond horrible.
Yeah. So my second agent was much better, loved my girl book, and Joe Monte, and so he's the one that actually ended up selling it to my editor, Phoebe A., when she was at Harper. And so that's how the Prophecy series ended up there.
Okay. I really actually love some of the choices that you made with the Prophecy series. Not only that, you kind of played with the very real assumption that people like assume that if there's a chosen one, it has to be a boy, especially in a patriarchal society such as ancient Korea.
Exactly.
But you made Kira really despised by people, like not just because she was a girl, but because she was a demon hunter. And then it made it so much more dynamic when she had to deal with the fact that she was the chosen one on top of all of that. And I just wonder, like, what went into kind of making that? Was it like a formed character that you knew that that's who it had to be, or did it develop as you figured out the story?
So I'm an outliner, and I write very, very detailed outlines. Like, they will run from 10 to 20 pages long. And then I'll do a shorter synopsis. That being said, things do change, right? A lot of things might change in the story of it, but some things don't. Like, my main character, Kira, was always meant to be somebody who was in a very difficult situation of being despised for everything that she was, and that couldn't really change. But I also wanted her to have a strong family base and have a family that cared about and believed in her, right? But I think that what it was not just the idea of here's this very strong female who's going to be despised because that's unusual, right? In a patriarchal society, but also that she's somebody that has a very different ability that makes her an other. And I think that that's always kind of like something that I'm playing with, because it's a feeling that I think most immigrant kids will have in their lives at some point. It's mm-hmm. that feeling of always being othered, whether it's for bringing a lunch that everybody's like, ew, what are you eating? Or how you look, or that you speak another language, or you have an accent, or your parents have an accent. All these things that are so othering in our society is always something that I'm thinking about. So when I'm writing a character, that the idea of being other is always there in some way.
From my understanding, or from me as a reader's point of view, Prophecy was the first book that I ever came across that was a young adult fantasy inspired by ancient Korea, written originally for like English speaking market. Like I'd watched like Seikuks before too, but like I never had a book like Prophecy before. And it was so amazing to be able to have this trilogy in front of me and be able to read it. And at the end of the day, I cannot deny that a lot of the reason why I had so much confidence writing my own identity into my own books was because of your book. Thank you for that. Yeah. And, but I also wanted to ask you, cause this has come up, recently, do you feel pressure? I think that you've done so much for opening up people's minds to the wonderful breadth of ancient Korean history, but sometimes I feel pressure. I'm there's so few of us writing and I want to get it right. And it's a big responsibility. And I'm just wondering if that ever affects you and how you might deal with it.
I don't think about it. I mean, what I think, no, it's true. I don't think about that. And if anybody were to say something like that to me, I'd probably just shrug it off. Because for me, the most important person is the kid reader, right? Or even the adult reader. It's whoever picks it up and is in some way inspired by the story. That there's no better feeling in the world. And I want to be right for whoever picks up my book. And when I mean right, I don't mean like being perfectly accurate in my depiction or my history and all that. I mean, just hitting that right tone, that right feeling, that they read the book and it meant something to them in some manner. And that's who I write for. I don't write for this, anonymous feeling of having to write for a community as much as I write for the kids who are going to read it. So I'm not going to sit here and say, now I can only write about Korean kids and only write about Korean culture. I'm writing what I want to write, period. And I hope that's true for you too, Kat. It doesn't matter what people say. You have to feel true to the writing of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Fuck people.
Yeah. Screw you guys. Write what I want.
Wait. Is this rated R?
It is. Yeah, it is. Ellen, you've cursed 20 times. Okay. But you're good. It's definitely, cursing is loud.
No, I love that. And thank you for saying that. It's actually really good to hear, not only because I have so much respect for you as a human being and as a writer, but because I think that I do think that we let ourselves be mired down in so much extra weight. And sometimes we just need to have fun.
Yeah, for sure.
We're allowed to.
Yeah. No, I mean, the whole reason that we should write anything isn't because we're trying to do a moral lesson, right? Mm-hmm. Or a historical lesson. It should be because we're going to tell a good fucking story that people want to read. That's our goal. And going to our goal, we're going to do it respectfully. We're going to make sure that the kids are represented. We're going to, do all the right things on the way, but we don't take away from the fact that we are writing a damn good story that we want to write.
I love that. Yes, I agree. So Ellen, you said you're on your fourth agent. So you moved on from your first agent, I'm guessing because of that heinous comment, or maybe other things. So there are a lot of authors who sort of don't know that that's normal to have more than one agent. So how did you, what do you think are like the important things that you look for when you're looking for that match of someone that you want to work with?
I think it's really hard because it is a business relationship. So there's got to be trust involved, trust in the process, trust that your agent has your back and that they're going to do a really good job representing you. And really, I think the hardest thing for most new writers is when they get into a relationship with an agent and they know, they can feel that it's not going well. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to take that step and, you know, to step away because they're like, oh my God, what if we never get another agent? Blah, 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 right? We all know that fear. And that fear is wrong because I know everyone says it, but I'll say it too. No agent is better than a bad agent.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the sort of process of you going on sub the first time, you'd say?
I think that I found that whole process horrifying. Because the first time you go on submission, you really don't know what to do. You are literally like sitting there staring at your inbox, constantly refreshing it.
yes.
You're feeling your life during the way. And you feel like everything, your whole entire future is riding on this one manuscript. And if that doesn't sell, then what are you going to do? Like, you can't get away from all those kind of like negative feelings. And the voice in your head that sounds like Joan Rivers is going, oh my God, you're never going to sell a book.
And, I hate you. Oh, that sounds just like my voice, I tell you.
Oh my gosh, right? So, like, I think that it was, I think it was just a very difficult time. I don't know if other people have an easier time when they're on submission. I just know that for me, I thought being on submission that first time was horrifying. Like, mm-hmm. I just found out a lot about myself. Like, you know, I am very, very insecure in ways that I didn't think I was, you know,
yeah.
And that I had so much self-doubt that here I was, like, I'd been practicing law for so many years. I'd been very successful in my other life. And then now I was like back to feeling irrelevant, mm-hmm. feeling like, you know, totally not up to this process, which, by the way, nobody is, because none of us knows how this really works. Half of it is luck, half of it is timing, half of it is getting the right agent. I mean, just it's really hard to know what are all the factors to making a book sell. And the only thing that we have any control over, and the only thing that works for me, is to just work on that next project.
Yep. It's evergreen advice, because that's all you can control.
Exactly. That is the only thing we can control. And I think that especially for people who come from other professions looking into publishing, it's the one thing they're like, they can't really understand, because isn't it a meritocracy? If you work really hard, shouldn't you be rewarded for that, you know? No, that's not how it works at all.
Nope, definitely not how it works. The unfortunate realities. Everything you said about the submission process, I felt that too. We told the story before, but literally I complained way too much to Clarabelle about my submission.
No, you didn't complain way too much. You were unreasonable about the things that you were complaining about. Because you were saying that the book was never going to sell, and it had been like 3 months. And I was like, you are bananas. And literally, Ellen, I started this podcast to prove to Kat that people were on sub way longer than she was. That is the origin story of Write or Die.
this true friendship. And she started a whole podcast to drag me.
I will tell you a funny story. I got an agent rejection letter for Prophecy 3 years after I had queried that particular agent.
Oh, gosh.
Who ended up being one of my agents.
Oh, my God.
Oh, what? Oh, no. I did not think that's how it was going to end.
Plot twist.
Yeah. Anyway, no. So it's a funny story. But my point in saying that is, like, I think I was on submission for, well, I mean, do I count that first time with my first agent and then when I had to rewrite the whole thing? Yeah. Because that feels like I was on sub for like 3 years then, you know?
Oh, gosh. I would have died.
Did you?
Claire won't be my friend anymore.
Were you literally on sub for 3 years, or did you say you just felt that it was like three
I
years?
I felt like it was.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I had pulled it, and then I had, you know, revised it, and then I had tried again. So, but it does. It feels like it's like purgatory, and
yeah.
Like you will never get out of that situation. And I think that it's probably a feeling that we've all felt, right?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. So do you think that you've gotten better now from when you first went on submission to, like, when a book is on sub now? Are things different for you? Or do you feel like you still need to sort of be working on that next thing so you don't spiral?
I think I'm in a very, very fortunate place right now that I have editors that I love working with that I think are brilliant and who I can talk to about projects and then come up with a proposal for and then kind of sell it on a proposal. And that is not very normal, I guess. I mean, I think it's maybe, I mean, I don't even know what the norm is anymore, to be honest. So I can only say that I know that I'm very fortunate.
Yeah, I think that when you get to a certain point, because I've talked to other authors who sort of are in that same boat, who have an established track record of, like, you know, books and are doing well and have, like, their readers that love them. And it's sort of the same situation, but you had to sort of work your way up, obviously, to that point. And I mean, you're incredible because not only have you sort of gotten to this point, but you've done so much for other authors to get to that point too. And so many people that I've talked to have mentioned a marked difference from before and after We Need Diverse Books and everything that's done for the industry. So just like a collective thank you.
As we told you, this is going to be a Ghost-tober episode. Claire will put a sound effects on that.
Okay, I will.
okay, we don't even need sound effects. We got it.
Yeah, see? I got it.
One of the reasons why we really wanted you to be one of our guests is because I read Spirit Hunters and it scared the bejesus out of me. And I feel like this happens to me so much, actually, with middle grade. I read it and I don't expect it to be as scary as it often ends up being.
Yeah.
Like, it's, but I loved it because it was so well done, because it wasn't just like scary, scary, scary. It was like scary, funny, weird, scary, like all this other stuff. And then obviously I you know, personally really loved the Korean elements in it. But how do you find the balance between, like, all of those elements so that the moments where it is kind of like spooky or scary, like, have the highest impact it can have in the story?
So I think that if you want to scare somebody to death, you want to also make them laugh, right? Like, it's kind of like, the way I see it is, there are two things that make you pee your pants, other than also being pregnant and having babies. But, you know, you laugh really hard and you pee your pants, or you get scared so badly you pee your pants, right? Those two are very closely tied. So you want to have humor and fear work together to make sure that you're not just, like, you know, bombarding your reader with just scary, 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 which, well, sometimes it's funny too, but that's more like for me, finding it funny when people are scared. So that's,
oh my gosh.
Okay. But, like, I think for me, what I wanted to make sure was that I was actually relating an actual, like, how a kid would react to all of these things. And I think that it's just a normal thing. Kids find things funny. Kids are going to try to lighten things up. And then kids are also going to be scared shitless about things. And so I wanted to just make sure that flow and that rhythm was there. It's kind of like why I love that relationship between Harper and Dio, because they could be that, you know, that strong friendship that they can laugh together and joke together and then be there for each other. And that was really important for me, to have that dynamic. And I think having that dynamic makes the scary not as scary.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
I agree. It definitely has to be a balance, because then it loses its sort of, like, you lose sensitivity to it in the book itself. If it's always scary, then it's like, all right, you have to sort of surprise them, I feel like, at a certain point. So I really love that. Exactly. And agree.
Well, you said earlier that you sometimes find it funny when you scare people. Was there anything that you wanted to include in either book that, like, after the fact, you're like, maybe this is too scary, and you had to take it out?
Yes. So, like, you know, my editor is fabulous. I love my editors. I have my Harper editor is Allison Day, and my Random House Crown editor is Phoebe Yeh, and they're both terrific. And so Spirit Hunters was with Allie, and it's one of those things where, like, Allie doesn't tell me, like, to maybe make it less scary or anything. She's just like, yeah, it's great. And I literally had this scene, and it was really gruesome, even for me. And I was like, okay, because I had this head, it was a beheading, and the head went rolling and then landed at this girl's feet. And I'm like, oh, Allie's definitely going to make me take that out. And, like, Allie read it and was like, oh, it's fine. If you think it's fine, we can go with it. And then I was just like, thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I said, yeah, maybe I should take that out. It was just a little bit too gruesome.
Did you have to ask, like, your kids for advice about that at all? Because at this point, weren't a couple of them middle grade age?
Yeah. I actually asked my kids for help on all my books, right?
Aww.
And they were like, just another aside, a funny story. For Prophecy, my oldest child had read it. And when she finished, she said to me, Mom, you can't kill everybody off. You gotta have somebody to root for at the end of your book.
And that's great advice.
It's really good advice. That's why there's quite a few characters that survived. I had originally killed them all off. So,
oh gosh.
Except for the dog, because, you know, I learned the hard way that you cannot kill a dog in any book.
No, you can't. You can kill anyone.
But a dog. So.
Yeah, you can kill any human, but you can't kill animal. Like, you can't kill a dog or pets, usually. Yeah.
Oh, did I tell you? I had an email once. Here's another aside. This woman wrote to me and said, I really enjoyed Prophecy, and I want to read the next two books, but I refuse to read them unless you tell me, does the dog die?
Oh.
And yes. No, I'm kidding. I didn't.
Oh, my gosh.
Of course. I said, no, Jindo lives. Everyone else dies, but the dog lives.
I remember I got a note from my agent once, right before we went on submission, where she was like, you have to make it very, very clear that the dog is okay after, like, that scene where they get attacked in the woods. She was like, it's really important for me personally that you make it clear that the dog is okay, because my agent's a dog person. And I was like, I mention her name later, and she's like, no, you have to have Ji-hoon go into the room and check on her and be like, are you okay? And so I had to add that in. I had to add it in.
That is my favorite thing ever.
I totally understand. As dog people, you can't do that. You cannot hurt the dog. Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, no, I agree now. It's just like, I knew the dog was okay. I wasn't worried, but literally everyone else was worried. So
But it's also, that's like my daughter was saying, like, you killed everybody but the dog. I was like, yeah, the dog should survive, even if nobody else does.
Yeah, there. I agree. People ask me about Chunk too. The cat.
Chunk's the cat in
Ghost Squad. They're like, Chunk's gonna be okay, right? And I'm like, she is. Don't worry.
Readers end up caring about is like really fascinating to me sometimes.
Yeah, it is really funny. It's almost never the thing that you think that they're gonna care about.
Right.
All right, Ellen, so can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming release, The Dragon Egg Princess?
Yeah, so I call it my Studio Ghibli-esque fantasy novel. Ooh. And it's about a dragon, an egg, and a princess. I actually did that at a school once, and the kids just stared at me very blankly. And I was cracking up. So that was the teachers are cracking up, and I was cracking up, and the kids were just looking at me. And I was like, okay, that was a terrible joke. And they're like, oh, that was a joke. And I was like, yeah, okay. But it's about like a world that has kind of been set back in time because it has magic, and a kid who has no magic in a land full of magic, who meets a princess who's descended from dragons. And so I'll leave it there for now. But I had a lot of fun writing that story because I think what it let me do was go back to fantasy after writing horror. There is something really freeing about just writing about a completely fantastic world. So I really enjoyed that.
I was super excited about that book when it was first announced. And the cover is really whimsical looking. So I'm really excited about it. I have it in my hands.
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed writing that. And I'm hoping that the kids like it, too. It is it's one of those books that I like. I just really put in all of the fantasy elements that I've always loved most about, you know, fantasy, like having enjoyed reading fantasy from a very young age, you know, I got to just take a stab at writing what I would have wanted to read.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And then you have a new young adult series coming out as well. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so that probably is not coming out till summer 21, and it's called The Colliding Worlds of Mina Lee for now. And it's about a girl who's a webcomic artist who creates a webcomic world, and she finds herself sucked into the world and realizes that she has, you know, tried to control something, and now everything has gone amok.
I love that. I love that the whole, so like...
interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially as creators, like we all create stories, and then to think that we could potentially actually be affecting real beings would be horrifying because we're not nice.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a Sims element going on there. Like, what if we're being controlled by the Sims, which is by someone, and we're just Sims, and that's the scariest thing ever. I love it. That's so cool.
That's so funny. I'd never thought of it that way, but yeah. So one of the funniest things I did was, like, I got to kind of, like, very tongue-in-cheek have, like, a lot of tropes in. And, like, she, you know, my character is now in the webcomic world, and she has to deal with all these tropes that the world is throwing at her. And she's like, no, not a, you know, not a love triangle. And no, oh, my God, this is everything in the kitchen sink and all that. So I had a lot of fun with that.
That sounds really fun. I'm so excited for that. So, Ellen, everybody who is on the show tells us either their most embarrassing publishing-related story or something they wish they'd known before they started. So you can tell us either or. You can do both. It's up to you.
So I don't remember what the most embarrassing thing I've done because it probably was so embarrassing that I have blocked it from my memory. That must be it. That's relatable. I know myself. Yeah, I know I've probably done many embarrassing things. One of the reasons why We Need Diverse Books has such a strong mentorship and, like, you know, talking to each other and being more of a community element to it is because I think that being a writer can be so lonely, right? It's isolating. Yeah. And it makes you feel like you're just like here throwing things into an abyss and nothing is ever happening. And I think that that I didn't know at the time that there was a community. And it took me a while to find that community. But once I did, I did feel like everything became easier, even though I think it's still hard. But, you know, having a sense of community makes the hard easier, right? At least easier to deal with. For me, it is really like knowing that there is a community and that that community can be a lifesaver. I think that that was something I did not know. And I'm so glad that I found. And what I hope for new writers is that they find that community earlier. Because I think that that is, you know, that can be the difference from those who just like give up and those who still try, who still continue.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's gotten a little bit better probably in the last 5 years just because we exist so much on Twitter. I mean, I personally think that there's still positive from Twitter. I know a lot of people don't think so.
I think that Twitter was an amazing tool to help a lot of communities get established. And yeah. I'm very grateful for it. I'm just right now for my own mental health, it's been much better not to be exposed to the more toxic elements of Twitter.
Yeah, I totally get that.
I mean, for sure. And you're such a prominent voice too. I think it does change when you start to just have more people looking to you for things and depending on you for things. And yeah, we've talked about it before on the podcast, but like taking a break from things for your mental health is so important.
Yeah, nobody needs to be on there if it's not the right fit for them too, because I think that sometimes there is pressure for people to be on Twitter. And I feel like if you know it's not going to be conducive to you living a healthy life, then don't be on it. You know, that's definitely something people need to take into account. You can find your community in other ways, or you can find them on there and then leave. Just take it to Slack, small groups.
Exactly. Yeah,
for sure. So Ellen, thank you so much for doing this with us. We both admire you so much, and we really appreciate you being on this episode. Can you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
I still am on Instagram and Tumblr. So I think my Instagram account is LOEcho, and my Tumblr might be the same. I don't know.
We'll put a link in the show notes for everyone so they can follow you on there. So thanks again, Ellen. We're so excited for all your new projects that are coming out.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening to Write or Die. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a review, and while you're at it, be sure to pick up Wicked Fox by me, Kat Cho, and Ghost Squad by Claribel A. Ortega.
See you next time, Wordies.
And don't forget to spread the word.